Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
An Air Asia passenger jet disappears between Indonesia and Singapore, and a desperate rescue effort underway in the Adriatic Sea. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. A search operation in the Java Sea for a missing Air Asia plane with 162 passengers and crew aboard has been scaled back for the night. Indonesia says its vessels remain in the search overnight, but flights are suspended until dawn. The flight by the low-cost airline departed in Indonesia a little before 6 a.m. local time and disappeared 42 minutes later, as VOA's Steve Herman reports.
Indonesia Air Asia Flight 8501 departed Surabaya in Indonesia for Singapore's Changi Airport on what should have been a routine 2-hour and 15-minute flight over the Java Sea. The Director General of Aviation for Indonesia's Transportation Ministry, Joko Admojo, told reporters that the last transmission from a crew member on the Airbus A320 came at 6:12 a.m. local time. He says the pilot stated that he was trying to avoid clouds and was moving left of the intended route and requested permission to climb. 6 minutes later, the plane disappeared from radar. The low-cost AirAsia family of airlines has had no fatalities since beginning operations 18 years ago. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Rescuers from several countries are trying to save hundreds of desperate passengers stranded aboard a burning ferry off the Greek island of Corfu. Greek and Italian air crews are trying to lift passengers from the Italian-flagged Norman Atlantic, with gale-force winds and high seas complicating their efforts. Meanwhile, Greek and Italian firefighting and merchant vessels are heading to the area and forming a barricade around the stricken ship. A Coast Guard says about 150 of nearly 500 passengers have been rescued. And a shipment of international relief supplies has arrived in Conakry, Guinea, to help the West African nation combat the Ebola outbreak. This is VOA News. The United States and NATO formally marked the end of their war in Afghanistan with a ceremony in Kabul today. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad.
A special ceremony was organized at the Kabul headquarters of the coalition Sunday to mark the conclusion of operations by the U.S.-led International Security Assistance Force, or ISAF. Its commander, General John Campbell, rolled up the green and white ISAF flag and unfolded the flag of a new so-called Resolute Support Mission.
Our new Resolute Support Mission reflects NATO's continued investment in Afghanistan's future. Our commitment to Afghanistan endures.
NATO's Resolute Support Mission will consist of around 13,000 mostly American personnel that will continue advising, assisting and training Afghan national security forces in their fight against the Taliban. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Rescuers in Malaysia are struggling to reach thousands of people affected by the country's worst flooding in three decades to deliver food and medical aid. By Sunday, five people were dead, more than 160,000 displaced by rising waters in at least eight states. Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak has cut short his vacation to lead the response and Saturday visited the worst-hit state of Kelantan, where 8,000 people are cut off. The Malaysian leader announced $143 million in new aid for the hardest-hit regions. Vice President Joe Biden and other dignitaries paid tribute to former New York police officer Rafael Ramos, one of two officers shot and killed by a lone gunman last week. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, along with the City of New York's Mayor Bill de Blasio, and thousands of officers from around the country joined the tribute at a church in New York. Mr. Biden said the country joined in mourning Ramos.
So when an assassin's bullet targeted two officers, it targeted this city, and it touched the soul of the entire nation.
Ramos and his partner Wen Jianlu were assassinated at point-blank range sitting in their patrol car on a Brooklyn street December 20th. Ahead of the killings, the shooter said he would avenge deaths of unarmed black suspects who died as police attempted to take them into custody. He later killed himself. Funeral arrangements for Officer Liu are still pending. Snow and ice have stranded 15,000 vehicles and those inside them, snarling holiday traffic to and from ski resorts in the French Alps. One man died when his vehicle slid into a ravine. The government is asking drivers to exercise the utmost caution and avoid travel if possible. More than three-quarters of the country is under a severe weather watch. Heavy snow is also disrupting roads in Germany, causing a 25-kilometer traffic jam on the A8 motorway near Stuttgart. And in Britain, officers are issuing warnings of ice across the country and heavy snow in some areas, and some hundreds of homes are without power in parts of England. I'm Marty Johnson in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
From the beginning, when the crisis started in December 15, 2013, he has decided to go into South Sudan.
Rebels loyal to former South Sudanese Vice President Riek Machar are unhappy at the continued presence of Ugandan troops in the country.
During our national secretariat fundraising, where he said he's appealing to those people that have lost in their primaries not to leave the party.
A prominent supporter of Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan threatens to defect from the ruling People's Democratic Party.
Nobody has gotten sick here, and I think that Newsweek was continuing a very long pattern by the Western media of painting Africa terribly.
And an African activist is displeased with U.S. media reports about Ebola in Africa. We'll have details. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The presence of Ugandan troops in South Sudan complicates peace talks between the administration in Juba and rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar aimed to end the conflict, according to Ezekiel Lolgatkuoth, a leading member of the rebel movement. His comments came after President Yoweri Museveni said he will withdraw Ugandan troops from South Sudan only after Juba is secured. But Gatko told me earlier that leaders should not allow South Sudan's sovereignty to be compromised by another country.
The problem is actually President Museveni himself, because from the beginning when the crisis started in December 15, 2013, he has decided to go into South Sudan to protect Salva Kiir so that he can maintain him in power. He had no legal mandate from the beginning to go to South Sudan. And this is a sovereign nation. He cannot just rush into it if there are crises. He's actually a senior elderly statesman. He should be focusing on mediating peace between the two brothers who quarrel instead of siding with one side. Yes, he's going to complicate the peace process because he's acting as if he's the president of the Republic of South Sudan. He's acting as if South Sudan is not a republic. That he's part of Uganda. This is a very unfortunate, but it is actually the making of Salva Kiir, because he's incompetent to protect and to lead South Sudan, because protecting sovereignty is to make sure that South Sudanese are one and united and working together in peace.
South Africa, Nigeria, Rwanda, Chad, and Algeria are reported to be now getting themselves involved to help IGAD in the peace process. Do you support this new move by these countries to help South Sudan reach a peace agreement to resolve this conflict?
We really support that and welcome that. My chairman, Dr. Machar, Riek Machar Teng, has agreed that the role of Nigeria, South Africa, Rwanda, Chad, and Algeria is very important because they are there to support IGAD. The AU must end this war, and we are ready to settle with Salva peacefully. This war is not our war. We did not call for it. We don't want it. It was imposed on us by Salva. So we are for peace. And myself, Ezekiel Lolgatkuoth, I was detained, and I joined Machar to seek peace. We are for peace. Yes, the role of the five countries that I have actually named before is very critical. They must work together with IGAD to bring the two parties together to a peaceful solution so that we can get South Sudan back to stability and development.
Some of your colleagues who were detained with you are calling for South Sudan to be handed over to the UN to administer the day-to-day running of the country, because both sides have
failed, have yet to come to an agreement. People are dying. Do you share that sentiment of South Sudan being handed to be run effectively by the UN while you resolve your differences?
I totally humbly disagree with those who are calling for UN to take over. Yes, the UN should pressure the two parties, the warring parties, to bring peace as soon as possible. South Sudan is an independent country. South Sudanese voted for this country, and they did not vote this country to be handed over to the UN. So they are proud people. They wanted to be sovereign, an independent country, and they will manage their differences and run this country peacefully. Failure of leaders does not mean that South Sudanese they have failed to run this country. It is one individual called Salva Kiir who failed to unite South Sudanese, who failed to bring them together, who killed them, and who managed to destroy the country. We have a lot of resources, but the president of the republic, Salva Kiir, failed to actually utilize those resources for the development. The next generation or the coming leaders will manage to pick it up where it is and then unite the people of South Sudan and develop it to a better nation.
Ezekiel Lol Gatkuoth is a leading member of the South Sudan Rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. A staunch supporter of Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan has threatened to leave the ruling People's Democratic Party, or PDP. This after Labaran Maku, a former information minister, lost a PDP primary election to contest the gubernatorial election in Nasarawa State. I reach Abdoulaye Jallo, a spokesman for the PDP, for more about the discontent within the party.
We have to ask Labaran Maku to be patient. And before I even say that on behalf of the party, the president has said during our national secretarial fundraising, where he said he's appealing to those people that have lost in their primaries not to leave the party. Because if you contest an election and you lost, hopefully even the appointment that you can get within the system, if the PDP wins, is going to be even better. But the most interesting thing is Labaran Maku was a minister in this government. And before, when he was the deputy of the former governor, it was a bit hard for him. And then the PDP, look at how he has suffered, and then they compensated him with the minister. And I believe if he can do that, really it may look like a slap to the leadership of the PDP.
Some people are saying that his ultimatum to PDP is a warning that the PDP will lose the election in February. What do you say to that?
Well, you see, Peter, when an election is coming, you tend to hear a lot of stories. And as one Hausa proverb says, you cannot know a person who is eating food until when the soup finishes. Is he saying PDP is going to lose election in the country? Or he is going to lose election in Nasarawa?
Labaran Maku says, come what may, he's going to contest in Nasarawa State. Now, as a prominent member of the party threatening this and calling about what he said were to be the lack of internal democracy within the PDP, don't you think the opposition has a chance by drawing a bigger wedge within the PDP to weaken the party ahead of the election?
The one thing that you cannot avoid, you cannot doubt, or you cannot say you can stop it is, one, as a human being, he has an interest. He has a right to go to any party of his own choice. But at least he can look at the fact that PDP has done much to him by giving him a ministerial slot. And even when he's going to leave the ministership, there was a riot in the Federal Minister of Information that he should account for all the money he has collected when he was a minister. And then the federal government, the leadership of the party, has not even looked at that. They say, okay, that is an internal problem, which only EFCC and ICCC will look at it if there is even a problem. Let him come out, let him go and contest. And then through the gratitude of the PDP, he was allowed to contest.
You said the president called on those who have lost primaries to stay within the party and not to go. Some of them are not listening to the president. Does that mean that this confirms accusations from other opposition groups that the president is weak and unable to even marshal his own troops, and they say that Nigerians should not back him up or vote for him in the general election? What say you?
Well, the issue, Peter Koloti, you see, don't look at a statement of a president which people may decide to do otherwise as a weakness. That I will not agree. You see, the Constitution of Nigeria clearly spelled out that there is a freedom of association. But the most important thing is a word of elders is a word of wisdom. No matter the age of the president, at least he is the father of all in the country as of today. So if he seeks to ask you that, look, my son, do the right thing, and you decided to say, despite all what you have done to me, you know, I am betraying you to go away, that does not mean weakness. He is now, you are now exercising your right of franchise to go and join any of the political parties. But at least he is looking the fact that it is not only to contest an election that brought you to the party. No, you came to the party to build the party and to assist the country to move forward. So that is not weakness at all.
Abdullahi Jallo is a spokesman for the Nigerian Ruling People's Democratic Party, or PDP. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Ni Akwete, an African activist, is unhappy about a recent media publication stating that Africans have been smuggling bushmeat contaminated with Ebola to the U.S. In an interview with VOA's Vincent McCorry, Akwete says there's need for Africans to push back against such stereotypes.
I think my issue is that, especially Newsweek, had on its cover the picture of a monkey and saying that Africans in the United States were smuggling bushmeat contaminated with Ebola virus into the United States with zero evidence, no evidence at all. And it was fear-mongering of the worst kind. Ebola has not gotten into the United States. Nobody has gotten sick here. And I think that Newsweek was continuing a very long pattern by the Western media of painting Africa terribly. So, yes, I was furious.
Yes, and actually when I read some other articles, there were others who reacted to that kind of reporting, and they're saying, first, there's a mischaracterization of how the disease transmits from animals to humans.
Yes.
And that actually, in this particular case, the monkey was not even a factor.
It wasn't. It wasn't. And Newsweek has been called on for that. But in fact, my other beef is that, you know, there are several million, maybe 2-3 million people of African, born in Africa who live here and their families. And I think that we need to speak up, because what I have noticed from doing this work for more than 30 years is that when you speak up, then you get a good dialogue. If you keep quiet, there is a bullying factor. They will keep picking up on you. And there's a lot of latent racism in people's minds already about what Africa is, and what Africans are. So I think Africans need to speak up and show the facts.
I mean, I know we do a very fair reporting here at the Voice of America,
Absolutely. But
in your observing of how media report on Africa, do you feel that this time of, this time and age, that there's still a deliberate distortion of how things are taking place in Africa with an agenda, really?
Oh, I think so. I certainly believe so. And again, my evidence A, Exhibit A, is Newsweek. I mean, they were exaggerating, and it is clear to me that they were trying to stir up fear so that people will buy their newspapers saying, oh, my God, this is terrible. Let me read the details. So I think they did it just to increase their circulation, and there is a history of it.
Do you feel that if this was happening in other parts of the world, the reporting is a little different?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Even if we just take the question of viruses and disease, look, there are a lot of viruses that humans are susceptible to, and many of them come from nature. I mean, every year the United States develops new vaccines for flu. Right now is a flu season. Most of it jumps from poultry and in other countries like China. And you don't see Newsweek picking on Chinese Americans. You don't see them attacking the country of China. So I think this is deliberate, targeted at Africans. And once again, I think it's important for Africans to push back.
Yeah, so your beef here first is that you don't want to have Americans here having some kind of discomfort being closer to Africans who live here.
Absolutely. In fact, we went through some of this with HIV, you know, and so Ebola even, I mean, and they are not telling the truth about Ebola. You cannot get Ebola through the air. There are certain other diseases you can get through the air from other parts of the world. They don't focus on that. So again, I feel that this is targeted as Africans, and we don't want Americans being fed misinformation about Africans who live amongst them.
Ni Akwete is a U.S.-based African activist. He spoke with VOA's Vincent Macquarie here in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Cameroon's military has begun a crackdown on Nigerian businessmen in the Bakassi Peninsula who are suspected of evading taxes. Cameroon gained total control of the oil-rich region in August 2013 following an International Court of Justice ruling, but 90% of the inhabitants of the area are Nigerians. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports for VOA in Bakassi.
Stanley Obi, a provision store owner, says a curfew was imposed in the peninsula last week following disputes between businessmen and groups of tax collectors. He says the businessmen do not understand Cameroon's tax laws.
At times you see the council will come to collect theirs. After the tax will come, police will come. You see, you are just confusing the whole system, so you don't even know where to go again. So you are just there blocked. The whole year will finally discover that all your money you've paid for the tax.
Fresh fish retailer Na Eric says since Cameroon gained total sovereignty over the oil-rich peninsula, Nigerians in Bakassi have been victims of frequent harassment by Cameroon soldiers.
It is a means of killing our businesses.
Mayor Aboko Patrick of Kombo Abedimo, a locality in Bakassi, says all people living in his council area must pay taxes as agreed by Cameroon and Nigeria in various treaties that followed the ICJ verdict.
In the Green Tree, one of the articles says that there shall be no indiscriminate collection of taxes within the Bakassi Peninsula. It did not say that there will be no collection of taxes. But the Nigerians, who outnumber Cameroonians, understood that there was no collection of taxes.
Immediately after the ICJ ruling, the collection of taxes in Bakassi was suspended. But beginning August 14, 2013, residents had to start paying their share. Amandi Kletus, who sells electronics in the area, says it will be difficult for business people to pay taxes.
We have lived here, we know the system, and we are used to it. When they were under the Nigerian system, they were not paying taxes. But in Cameroon, the tax issue is general.
Bernard Okalia Bilai, governor of Cameroon's southwest region, where Bakassi is located, accused Nigerians of disrespecting the terms of the ICJ ruling by refusing to pay taxes.
On a tout simplement permis aux occupants.
He says Cameroon just wants them to understand that Bakassi is now a Cameroonian territory and whoever lives in it must pay their taxes and submit themselves to all rules and regulations of Cameroon. Okalia Bilai adds that his administration has imposed a curfew to stop people who come to Bakassi from Nigeria's Cross River State because they refuse to pay taxes.
Comme la communauté de concert.
He says the decision to stop people from traveling from Nigeria to Bakassi at night was taken after a meeting with the population following complaints that some robbers were disrespecting the maritime borders and attacking the population and refusing to pay their share of taxes. The International Court of Justice gave Nigeria a 5-year period of transition from 2008 to totally cede the disputed Bakassi Peninsula to Cameroon. As of August 14, 2013, Nigerians who constitute 90% of the 300,000 people on the peninsula had to obtain residence permit and be treated as foreign nationals living in Cameroon. Those who decided to be Cameroonians had to acquire national identity cards to be Cameroonians and respect Cameroon laws. The International Court of Justice had awarded Bakassi to Cameroon in a 2002 ruling. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Bakassi.
In East Africa, wildlife conservationists in Kenya are scrambling to save the rare species of rhinoceros that has been hunted and poached to the brink of extinction. VOA's Gabe Joso reports with just five of the animals left in the world, caretakers hope that through reproductive science, they may be able to preserve the gene pool before it's gone forever.
The northern white rhino that once roamed a territory stretching from Uganda through the Democratic Republic of Congo and as far north as Chad could disappear within our lifetimes. The Old Pajeta Conservancy in central Kenya is home to three of these animals. Under the watch of armed guards, they meander easily across a natural expanse of grass and shrubs and rub and play and eat with groups of southern white rhinos, their close genetic cousins. Mohamed Doyo has been caretaker to these animals since they arrived at the conservatory in 2009.
The one I'm touching here, she is called Najin, or you can call her Nai. Nai is 25 years old. Her daughter, she is 13 years old, and she is the last one born in the zoo. The other one is Sudan, the only male left in the world.
The rhinos came to Kenya from a zoo in the Czech Republic with the hope that the species would thrive in a more natural habitat. But that optimism has not been met with breeding success, and the population is dwindling fast. One of the rhinos here, Suni, unexpectedly died in October. A zoo in the U.S. city of San Diego lost another in mid-December. San Diego still has one left, as does the zoo in the Czech Republic. But the last wild population in the Democratic Republic of Congo was hunted and killed during armed conflicts in the last decade. Killings of all types of rhinos across Africa have been driven by Asian demand due to the mistaken belief that the horns have medicinal properties. Doyo files down the rhino's horns at Old Pajeta to make them less enticing to poachers. He also had a chance to lobby on behalf of the rhinos to a visiting Chinese basketball legend.
There was a guy here by the name Yao Ming. He was doing a documentary telling the China people should stop believing the horn of a rhino as a medicine. Instead of that, I told him they should use their fingernails or hair because it's one material.
Sudan, the last male of the species, is 41 years old, and his past attempts at mating were unsuccessful. So now conservationists will try to artificially impregnate a young, fertile female. If that does not work, they will try in vitro fertilization, possibly using a southern white rhino as a kind of surrogate mother. The last solution would be crossbreeding between the two species, which are physically and genetically similar. This is Richard Vine, CEO of Old Pajeta.
It's about preserving those genetic traits which confer upon the northern white as a species or a subspecies, whatever you want to call it, the ability to live in Central Africa with all of the disease and habitat challenges that that presents. Those genetic traits could be preserved as part of a hybrid with a southern white. But as long as they're there, then one day, hopefully, maybe in 100 years' time, we'll be able to reintroduce rhinos into that part of Africa.
The fact of the matter is the northern white rhino gene pool has been depleted to the point that preserving the animal as a unique species is quite a long shot. But Vine says this effort is not just about saving one type of rhino.
We're keen to make the point that, you know, if human beings continue to treat the planet in the way that they're treating it, this isn't going to be the only major mammalian species which goes extinct in the next few years. That's going to happen more and more and more.
Vine says the process is expected to get underway in January with the assistance of experts from the Czech zoo where they came from. The good news is that southern white rhino populations have rebounded in the last century since being pushed to the brink of extinction themselves. If crossbreeding is successful, then there is hope that some trace of the otherwise doomed northern white species may still live on. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Kenya.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Tote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. That will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and say good day to you, Segun Adeyemi.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, December 28th. It's just about 3 weeks to the kickoff of the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations to be hosted by Equatorial Guinea. The 16 finalists are making their final preparations for the football extravaganza. Within the past few days, many teams have released the names of their provisional squads. Tunisian coach Georges Leekens has called up 27 players, out of which 23 will make the final list, which must be sent to the African Soccer's governing body, CAF, by January 7th, 10 days before the tournament kicks off. The shortlisted players will train in Tunisia from January 2nd to 12th. They will also play a friendly match with Algeria on January 11th at the Rade Stadium near Tunis. The Carthage Eagles, as the Tunisian team is known, will then travel to Libreville, Gabon, on January 12th for the second round of preparation match against Mali before flying the next day to Bata, Equatorial Guinea, which will be their base during the tournament. For first round action, Tunisia is in Group B with Cape Verde, Zambia, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DR Congo. Congo coach Claude Leroy has also named a 26-member provisional squad that includes France-born defender Christopher Mabulo. The Bastia defender finally rescinded his decision to play for France. The 24-year-old made the squad alongside Belgium-based defensive duo Scott Bistindo of Anderlecht and Jordan Masengo of Mons. The Red Devils of Congo are expected to begin preparations on January 2nd in Brazzaville. 8 days later, they will travel to Senegal for a friendly against Cape Verde before heading back to Brazzaville on January 13th to wrap up for the tournament. Three players will be dropped from the final squad for the January 17th to February 8th, 2015 championship. The Congolese are in Group A with host Equatorial Guinea, Gabon, and Burkina Faso. They will face the host nation in the opening match of the tournament on January 17th in Bata. Meanwhile, Ghana coach Avram Grant has also named a 31-man provisional squad for the Nations Cup. Four uncapped players, Enoch Adukofi and Ibrahim Moro, who both play in Sweden, as well as Denmark-based Daniel Amate and Kwesi Appiah, who is based in England, are in the team. The Black Stars are in Group C with Algeria, South Africa, and Senegal. Ghana made it to the quarterfinals at the last four Nations Cup tournaments. Burkina Faso has also named a 24-member provisional squad that includes brothers Alain and Bertrand Traoré. The two brothers played for Burkina Faso at the 2012 edition of the Nations Cup, which was co-hosted by Gabon and Equatorial Guinea. Burkina Faso is expected to travel to South Africa early in the new year to commence preparations for the tournament. The team will play two friendlies against Swaziland and Botswana before traveling to Bata for the finals. Burkina Faso finished runner-up to Nigeria at the 2013 Nations Cup in South Africa. It is in Group A of the 2015 finals with host Equatorial Guinea, Congo, and Gabon. Another West African team, Senegal, has named a squad that includes striker Papiss Cissé. But a surprise omission from coach Alain Juret's team is Demba Ba, who has scored 16 goals for his Turkish club so far this season. Senegal is in Group C with Algeria, Ghana, and South Africa. The Teranga Lions of Senegal will open their training in the capital city of Dakar on January 2nd and then travel to Morocco 5 days later for more preparations. And Cameroon's preliminary 24-member squad has excluded midfielder Alex Song. Song has not featured for his country since he was sent off in the match against Croatia at the 2014 FIFA World Cup. Cameroon opens preparations at home early January before traveling to Gabon for more training. The Indomitable Lions are due in Malabo a day before the opening of the Nations Cup. Well, one team that has already named the final 23-member squad is Cape Verde. Portuguese coach Rui Agua's squad is made up of entirely overseas-based players. The 2015 squad includes 12 players who were part of the team that reached the quarterfinals in South Africa in 2013. The Blue Sharks will be preparing in Portugal ahead of the finals. They will play friendlies against host Equatorial Guinea, who are also preparing in Portugal, a Portuguese club, as well as Congo. Talking about preparations for the 2015 Nations Cup, Guinea is due to prepare in Morocco for the tournament. Let's recall that Guinea also played its home Nations Cup qualifiers in Morocco after being banned from hosting matches due to the outbreak of the deadly Ebola virus. The Sili National of Guinea is in Group D with Cameroon, Ivory Coast, and Mali. In other news, Ivory Coast midfielder Yaya Toure moved closer to a record fourth consecutive African Footballer of the Year title on Friday when he was included in a three-man shortlist. Gabon striker Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang and Nigerian goalkeeper Vincent Nyama are the other contenders for the most prestigious African Football Individual Award. Toure plays for reigning English Premier League champion Manchester City, Aubameyang for German club Borussia Dortmund, and Nyama for French outfit Lille. National coaches in Africa will vote to decide the winner, who will be announced on January 8, 2015 here in Lagos. Cameroon striker Samuel Eto'o has won the award four times, but only three of his titles were consecutive. The Africa-based Footballer of the Year award rests between Elhadi Balemiri and Akram Janit, both of Entente Sportive of Algeria, as well as Famim Mubele from DR Congo. Shortlists were also announced for the Women's Player of the Year, Youth Player of the Year, Most Promising Talent, Coach of the Year, National Team of the Year, Women's National Team of the Year, Club of the Year, Football Leader of the Year, and the African Legend Award. Finally, this good news for former football star George Weah of Liberia. Remember him? He's the only African player to have won FIFA's World Player of the Year, and that was in 1995. He's also a three-time winner of the African Footballer of the Year Award. Well, he has now won a seat in the Liberian Senate. The election to fill 15 of the 30 seats in the Senate were held on Saturday. In the most hotly contested race for the Montserrado Senate seat around the capital city of Monrovia, the former soccer star and 2005 losing presidential candidate faced off against Robert Salif, the son of the president, and he won with a landslide. Congratulations to George Weah. Since this is the last edition of Nightline Africa Sports for 2014, here is wishing you, Peter, and all our listeners, a happy new year. Now back to you, Peter Clote, in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sport. Nightline, Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
I've never seen a girl like this before, with a killing me slow, and the dance to the do too sweet, got a girl Tobado, sexy lady Tobado, this kind of dance to the do as on to, say which kind of dance yeah, you they do for me as on to, ha, see, see, say which kind of dance yeah, you they do, say this kind of dance to the do like say, you they use juju, say this kind of dance to the do like say, you they make me mad, oh, say this kind of dance to the do like say, you they make me crazy, oh. Say this kind dance they do for make me curse as on to. Say this kind dance they do they make man curse as on to. Say this kind dance they do too sweet for man as on to. Ha. Say baby dance yo kejijo. Ha. Kejijo baby dance yo kejijo. Ha. Kejijo. Oh yeah dance yo kejijo. Ha. Kejijo baby dance yo kejijo. Ha. Kejijo. Ha. To the verse 2, and the time is quarter past 2. Say the girl say make you go 10-2. She they ask if I go chop banku. Ha, I go chop banku. Mommy say I go chop banku. With the way you they do your sexy wine, why I no go chop banku? Ah, come on then. Maybe just come on then. Ha, best okay. Best okay. Ha, come on then. Maybe just come on then. Ha, best okay. Yeah, yeah, which kind of dance yeah, you they do? Say this kind of dance, they do like say, you they use juju. Say this kind of dance, they do like say, you they make me mad, oh. Say this kind of dance, they do like say, you they make me crazy, oh. Say baby, which kind of dance, they do as on to. Say this kind of dance, they do for make me crazy as on to. Say this kind of dance, they do, they make man crazy as on to. Say this kind of dance, they do too sweet for man as on to. Ha, say baby, dance your kejijo. Ha. Kejijo, baby, dance yo, kejijo, ha, kejijo, oh yeah, dance yo, kejijo, ha, kejijo, baby, dance yo, kejijo, ha, kejijo, ha.
African baby, photogenic.
Hey, you're photogenic.
The way you smile, they do me something. I no deny the way you make it yanga. Oh my baby, make I snap you photo. Make I snap you photo. Make I snap you photo. And I look at you, girl. Make I snap you photo. Young man, they spend the money. Oh, baby, nebumo, yanagia. Oh, yeah, one in if you could tell me, make we join body. So, making us some more. Baby, you got a different kind of beauty, girl, I never seen before. If I mistakenly fall in love with you, I look at one thing for more. I don't go Soweto, America, Toronto. If I say, make a call, the results. The number one, you be oh, I'm on a Niger photogenic. African baby, photogenic.
Hey, you're photogenic.
The way you smile, they do me something. I no deny the way you make it yanga. Oh my baby, make I snap you photo. Make I snap you photo. Make I snap you photo. And I look at you, girl. Make I snap you photo. Cause now you ready to blow my mind. I just wanna make you mine. I'm ready to go the extra mile for you, baby. You, got it go, oh, black in our beauty. Yes, got it go, oh, my yellow CC. I don't go Soweto, America, Toronto. If I say make a call, the results. So, the number one, you be oh, I'm a Niger photogenic.
Hey, you are photogenic.
African baby, photogenic.
Hey, you are photogenic.
The way you smile, they do me something. I no deny the way you make it yanga. Oh my baby, make I snap you photo. Make I snap you photo. Make I snap you photo. And I look at you, girl. Make I snap you photo. Make I snap you photo. Make I snap you photo. And I go carry you, girl.
Sweet.
Auntie, my sugar, my baby, my lover. We can ride around in the Rover, from Owerri all the way to Dover. My sweetie, my sugar, my baby, my lover. We can ride around in the Rover, from Owerri all the way to Dover. Don't leave my, wait a minute, but you could go ahead, just give it a digits. I'm a broken record, but you can fix it. Wiz did it, so I had to remix it. So photogenic, you don't need no makeup. Look the same in pics, the way she wakes up. I'm sorry, boo boo, but I had to tell you how.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. In a story published by the New York Times last Friday, the Department of Peacekeeping Operations in the United Nations Secretariat is contemplating a reduction of the strength of peacekeeping force in the fall in the Sudan. The United Nations is considering this move because it is not getting the appropriate and necessary support and cooperation from the government of the Sudan. But this is not new. From the beginning, the government of Sudan was reluctant to accept a United Nations peacekeeping operations in Darfur. Its preference was always for an African Union peacekeeping operations. Owing to the divergence of views and position between the Sudan and the United Nations, a compromise agreement was reached. That is a hybrid peacekeeping force in the fall, made up of the UN and the African Union. And that force was deployed. Although the hybrid force in the fall has definitely encountered difficulties, the United Nations has been able to manage the situation. The non-cooperation of a government with a United Nations peacekeeping force is not a sufficient reason for the reduction of its strength or to consider its withdrawal. For some time now, the government of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, has been demanding the withdrawal of the United Nations peacekeeping force from its territory. Yet, in view of the damage that could and should, neither the Security Council of the United Nations nor the Secretary General has seriously complied with the request of the government. Another concern mentioned by the New York Times is the constant attacks on the UN force by supporters of the government or the government itself. A fundamental principle of peacekeeping force as distinct from peace enforcement operation under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter is the need for cooperation with the host government, that is, the Sudan. Obviously, the denial of this cooperation presents serious problems. But the report in the New York Times did not disclose other important considerations that may have compelled the peacekeeping department to examine the issue of reduction of the troops' strength. Do we know whether the major financial contributors of the peacekeeping force are wary of the cost of the operation and therefore want to reduce because since the Darfur force is a UN-AU hybrid force, has the United Nations consulted fully with the African Union in Addis Ababa, particularly regarding the reduction of the troop strength or possible withdrawal? Or, as some have mentioned, is the hybrid force only a name only, with the United Nations making all major decisions without fully consulting with the African Union? These are pertinent questions because of the possibility that the risks may outweigh the reduction of the cost. In the Darfur in particular, the United Nations itself has recognized the risks to the civilian population in the Darfur, and it has reiterated its pledge to protect them. But we should not forget the fact that the United Nations contemplated the reduction of its force in Rwanda just prior to the genocide in 1994. This is why it is necessary for the utmost caution. Also, do we know whether some troop contributing countries to the Darfur force are concerned of the safety of their troops and are therefore sending signals to the United Nations Secretariat that they may want to consider withdrawing their troops? It is of the utmost importance that the African Union engage the United Nations Secretariat on this matter of troop reduction in Darfur. Unfortunately, also, the report in the New York Times linked the recent decision of the chief prosecutor of the ICC to suspend its case on Darfur. There should be no linkage between the ICC and Darfur. Definitely, the ICC has its problem with Africa, and that should be sorted out between the two parties. The dangers in Darfur are such that no one should make such a linkage. I thank you very much.
Thank you very much as well. That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jomna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. I hope you enjoy the program tonight. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Shegun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Kelvin Fowler, we say thanks for joining us. And as the elders say, do not let the shadows of your past darken the doorstep of your future. Forgive, forget, and move forward with pride. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United Nations Refugee Agency calls the crisis in Syria the biggest humanitarian emergency of our era. Since the Syrian civil war began in 2011, the civilian population has borne the brunt of the violence. To escape the violence, more than 3.3 million people have fled to neighboring countries. Of these, 10%, or roughly 300,000 people, are in dire need of resettlement to other countries, according to the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, or UNHCR. 28 countries, including the United States, have responded to UNHCR's recent call to open their doors for those most in need. pledging to create an estimated 100,000 opportunities for resettlement of Syrian refugees. For Syrians and for other victims of violence and persecution, resettlement offers not just an escape, but a chance to start over, said Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration, Ann Richard. The United States is the world leader in refugee resettlement, annually resettling more than all other countries combined. The United States accepts the majority of all UNHCR referrals from around the world, said Assistant Secretary Richard. Last year, we reached our goal of resettling nearly 70,000 refugees from nearly 70 countries, and we plan to lead in resettling Syrians as well. We are reviewing some 10,000 recent UNHCR referrals from Syria. We are receiving roughly 1,000 new referrals each month, and we expect admissions from Syria to surge in 2015 and beyond, she said. Since the violence started in Syria in March 2011, the United States has provided over $3 billion worth of aid to support refugees in neighboring countries and communities who have generously agreed to host them. This aid will continue even as we work to accelerate our refugee resettlement program. War's true cost is measured in human suffering. Resettlement can help, one person at a time, to bring that suffering to an end, said Assistant Secretary Richard. Resettlement cannot replace what refugees have lost or erase what they have endured, but it can renew hope and help restart lives. That can make all the difference.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.